Welcome to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Great guest today, Tom Holm, talking about his book, Ira Hayes, about one of the World War II heroes who raised the flag at Iwo Jima. Love this conversation. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. Really quick programming note. If you head to our Buzzsprout site, you can actually sign up for a subscription where just for a dollar or two a month, you can actually support this podcast. I mean, please. Mike constantly says he's going to quit. He's like, I'm done with it. I don't get paid enough to deal with you. So we probably need to pay him a little bit just to keep this whole thing going. I'm not threatening you. I'm just letting you all know. All right, I'll shut up. Let's bring on our guest. And here we are with author Tom Holm and his book, Ira Hayes, The Akmel Otham Warrior, World War II, and the Price of Heroism. Tom, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, Tom, how bad did I mess up the name before Warrior? We were talking about it before here. How'd I do?
Akmel Otham. Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, no, that definitely sounds much better. We're gonna skate right past it. I really tried. Tom, before we talk about Ira Hayes, which a lot of people know, one of the men who lifted the flag at Iwo Jima. But before we get there, you yourself, you're a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and Muscogee Creek descent. Can you tell us just a little bit about those people and just whether long, short, however you want to go?
Well, let's see. Both of the tribes were removed from their original homelands as a result of the Indian Removal Act and Andrew Jackson. And it was in the 1830s. The tribes were shipped as shipped. But, well, first, we were kind of rounded up and put in these camps or stockades and had to travel sometimes by wagon, sometimes by boat down various rivers. And out to what is now Oklahoma, it was Indian territory in the 1830s. I have family stories, for instance, of my grandmother was born, she's Cherokee, she was born in 1890. And she used to tell lots of stories that, you know, from either old Cherokee stories or some family stories. She talked about her Aunt Lizzie and that in one of the camps there was a cholera epidemic and her mother died. Aunt Lizzie's mother died. So, be a great great aunt of my grandmother's, so I don't know how far that is, but that's quite a way. And my grandpa was part Cree, and there was also stories about their removal.
Because Muscogee Creek, right, are one of the tribes very specifically affected by the Trail of Tears, right?
Yeah, so with Cherokee, both of the Cherokees, that's the one that I'm a citizen of. Creeks came from a very, very middle Alabama, Georgia, called Black Earth territory, and were sent out moving from that territory to Sod Prairie. So a big difference in their lives. We were both kind of woodland tribes and kept a lot of things together, a lot of religious things, especially the Creeks have several ceremonial grounds. Cherokees have, you know, I don't know how many there are left, but there were quite a few at in the beginning of the 20th century, and some of them have more or less played out. I often tell this in a story, you know, to my children and my grandchildren. I said, well, I had two choices, go on a wheat harvest and ended up in North Dakota or go on the Marine Corps. So,
do you think you made the right decision looking back on it?
I'm not sure.
Ira's one of those people that, you know, not a lot of people know a lot about World War II, but Ira Hayes is somebody that, you know, even people who don't read history, they'll know as soon as they hear the name. What made you decide that you wanted to write this book?
I did a book in the 90s about Native Vietnam veterans. And I went out and interviewed and did surveys of 170 guys, and I wrote a book called Strong Hearts, Wounded Souls. I really started to get into Native service in the United States military and made a lot of friends out there. You know, done it for a long time, and then, you know, most of the folks that know me know what I'm doing with all of this. And got some good friends out there that are doing things on Native people who were in the military, like Bill Meadows. He's in Missouri. He's done a whole bunch of books on Native warrior societies and also code talkers. He's into that. So I guess you'd say a kind of a new genre or whatever within history. Yeah, 12 called up a couple of people asking, you know, who should do something like this or who could look into Ira's life and service and things like that. And a couple of people suggested me.
And we'll get into specifics But what I felt like, especially once I finished the book, is it almost felt like you were writing a correction to the historical record.
Trying to.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's there. There's this strong undercurrent. I felt like you were writing about a fellow soldier who you think got, and I'll use a military term, shafted in the historical record, that he wasn't given the due, he wasn't given the grace that he deserved. And it felt like this book is almost kind of holding that up and asking people to say, like, hey, like, look at this with new eyes. Because, I mean, we're jumping ahead, but Ira was known for the flag raising, but then a lot of people just like, oh, and then he fell into alcoholism and that's it. And for me, it felt like when you wrote this book, it's, hey, there's more to him than this, and there's more to understand than what you think you know.
Yeah, that's what I've tried to do. He was quite a guy. He's got this sort of reputation that he was quiet and, you know, he didn't say anything. And that's largely from the movies. When he was with his buddies, you know, he was quite a joker. One of the things that he did that cracked me up was that he used to open beer bottles with his teeth.
Sounds like a Marine.
So I've often wondered about this too. And this, and he was kind of a perfect example, because his drinking, I hesitate to call him, you know, one of the confirmed alcoholics, because I used to know winos, and he was much more like kind of a typical rural farm worker. You go out there and you do this labor, intensive labor, and I hauled hay and I picked stuff and all this kind of stuff. And it's really, really difficult. I mean, you're out in the field, you know, 10 hours a day and stuff like that. And you go have a few drinks on the weekends.
I mean, you earned it, right? You worked hard all week.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that Ira did. I would classify him doing what I did after I got back, and that's kind of binge drinking. And you could show up at work and do your thing all week and then hit a few bars afterwards. The thing about it is that he got busted all the time because he was a brown person out there getting drunk. And at that time, in the late 40s and early 50s in Arizona, that was, I don't know, a habit that the cops would stop a drunk white guy, hand him a citation, and then they would stop a guy who doesn't look like them, typically a brown guy, and haul him off to jail. There was reported that Ira had been arrested for drunken disorderly 50 times in the span of 10 years. And I'm saying, wait a minute, that's 5 times a year. They really liked to bust Ira.
What would growing up for him look like, where he was, who he looked like? What would the years before he joined the service look like?
It was a rugged upbringing. His parents were born, I think it was 1901 and 1902, and they were born during a time that there was a real famine that was on that reservation, caused primarily by actually the theft of water. Ira's people had been probably among the most sophisticated farmers around. They had irrigation systems and the whole shop, mainly off that river. Akimel means river, while Otham means people. When the Americans started to come in, the water was siphoned off through various means. To this very day, they're trying to get the water back.
I mean, there was just a big Supreme Court case just a few weeks ago, right, on this specific subject.
Yeah, well, especially on treaty rights and stuff like that. That's true. You know, it hasn't really been resolved. I try to put this in kind of a context. There's a guy who was a student at one time, Dave DeYoung, who's a student at the University of Arizona, has done magnificent work on the river and siphoning off of the river, and both the Gila River and the Salt River. Another guy that you have to acknowledge is Dave Martinez. He's at ASU, who's been doing work on the Akimel. He is Akimel Otham. He's been doing a good deal of historical work on that. But the famine occurred in about 1880 past 1900, and there were a lot of folks dying. The livestock was dying all over the place and that sort of thing. So it was an incredibly poor area. Ira himself had, him and the rest of the kids were doing really difficult labor, trying to farm, trying to take care of livestock and this kind of thing. And then he joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Indian Division. They even set aside the Indian Division.
And then for Ira, you know, kind of at the beginning of World War II, you know, he grows up in a terrible environment. There would be a lot of reasons to not be a huge fan of the American government. So, you know, he signs up to become a Marine for World War II. You know, how much of that was he wanted to get out of what he was doing, right, out of the CCC? How much of it was patriotism? You know, what really drove him to join the Marines for World War II?
Well, the Akhmelov themselves had a kind of a long military tradition. A lot of that is the first Arizonan, for instance, who was killed in World War I, was Akhmelov by the name of Matthew Wan. The Otham fought with the Americans against the Apaches and other tribes. And like I said, I have a long military tradition. We were part of the Indian Scouts. One of the things, too, is that the Indian schools at the time, you know, taught this brand of nationalism, especially after the war, World War II started. Every day they got up and sang military songs and things like that. And that was going on for quite a while. Plus, his Presbyterian background was very much into the idea of service and, you know, serving not only God, but your country and things like that. And so it's a blend of things, I think, that Ira got caught up in his own culture, the places that he was educated. He was educated in a Presbyterian. Plus, the Indian schools at the time, it was kind of interesting because I don't think there would be very many high schools that do this, but the Indian schools at the time, they actually had recruiting at the schools themselves. There was a famous company that 45th Division in World War II had fought in Italy. I think they had two or three companies that were all Indian companies within the 45th Division. It was very much a part, I guess, of the Taliban culture at the time.
I mean, it's very complicated when I try to think about somebody like Ira going into these units, too, because you're talking about, you know, World War II, there were still, you know, semblances of segregation, depending on who you were and things like that. And then, you know, for one thing, then you point this out in the book, they called him chief, and he really didn't like that, right? Because it's at some point, you know, there may be a part of it that people are trying to be cute. They think it sounds cool or something like this, but it's also kind of insulting. But I remember even I read a book on World War I where it pointed out that in World War I, the Germans were afraid of American Indians because they literally thought they were somewhat magical, that there were these special types of warriors. You know, I can never understand, but, you know, Ira's there. He's part of the group. He wants to be part of the group. You know, you and I both know you get in the military, you want to just blend in. Don't stand out. It's a bad thing. And one of the first things that happens, he starts getting called chief, and he kind of just has to deal with it. He has to kind of make it his own, right?
Yeah, everybody got called chief. Everybody. My cousins, me, and everybody else, you know, we were at one time called, you know, chief. And I think that it bothers you, but at the same time, it's a way in. I think that the military, what it does, especially the Marine Corps and the Army, it seems like the Air Force and the Navy don't do this, but very, very much this whole idea of team is part of that. And so I think that, you know, he grew up with a community orientation, is that it wasn't just him going out and, you know, and taking care of the livestock. It was his brothers and sisters and cousins. And it was a communal thing. So as you grew up, you know, pick the cotton, pick this, pick that, you know, as an age group. And I think he grew up like that. And he saw in the Marine Corps the same thing. And he had these real, real good friends that he interacted with. You know, they were all separated and all scattered every once in a while. Then he would make more of them, but a good number of them. He was portrayed by Tony Curtis in The Outsider movie as a kind of a bumbling guy. He was one of the Marines who got into parachute training, and that took a lot. He was no bumbler. He was athletic, and he was, you know, a really solid kind of team player and Marine. You know, and I think that the whole business about the team player comes from his upbringing. Back in Oklahoma, Cherokees have a thing called Gadugi. And what that is it's a working group, a group that goes together to do all various kinds of things, you know, help the neighbors out or you know, slaughter hogs or doing all kinds of things like that. And I think that's the way it more or less worked.
And you point out, too, he joins that parachute unit. and then gets pulled out of it right before everything happens, Iwo Jima and all that stuff. And you said that was something pretty traumatic for him, because like you said, the community, whatever it is super important. And then he's in the middle of war, and then he's pulled out of the community that he's built and kind of made his name in, right?
Yeah, well, they went to Bougainville together. The 3rd Parachute Regiment went to Bougainville together, so they fought together. They, in many ways, I mean, that was a largely forgotten battle of the Pacific War. Bougainville was dark, dank, smelly, rainy jungle, replete with everything, you know, from leeches to centipedes and everything else. It was kind of on the order of Vietnam, but then after Bougainville, they disbanded all the parachute units. One thing, though, that was kind of interesting is that when they disbanded them, they sent them a large number of the parachute and the raiders. They were kind of trained together. The way it ended up is in the 5th Marine Division, when they formed it at Camp Pendleton in late 44, they put a lot of the parachute guys and the raiders in that division. So he knew some folks from the parachute stuff and then from the raiders, and they were in his company, and his squad leader, I think Mike Strank, he was killed, and I think that he was a parachutist, and there were a couple of raiders in his squad. This kind of elite group, you know, they got disbanded, come together at Iwo.
And having the different units ends up pretty interesting when we talk about the very famous raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. Two things very interesting I don't know that everybody knows is that, first of all, that was not the first flag raising. And number two, right away, especially for a very long time after, we didn't know exactly who was doing it. We didn't know the names of all of the soldiers that were doing it, right?
They didn't actually come up with the names of the 6 in that photograph until 2019. You know, they had to cut out some guys that were, everybody thought was in there. The first one that had to be brought in that was excluded was actually, it was because of Ira. His friend was Harlan Block, and Harlan was killed on Iwo. Harlan was the guy who was actually shoving the flag into the ground when everybody else was raising it. This pole was a big, big, heavy lead pipe. So Harlan was the one that was guiding it in. They had another guy that was named for it, and Ira more or less corrected it by saying that, or he actually went out and he hitchhiked from Arizona out to Texas. That's where Harlan was from. And he hitchhiked out there and met Harlan's dad. And he told Harlan Block's dad that it was Harlan who was doing it, not this other guy. So his dad then told his mother, and Harlan's mother said, "I knew it was him all along. I knew it was his butt. I changed that boy's diaper, and I knew it was him." So now the last two guys that were a guy named Harold Schultz. He was alive, and he helped raise. I think it was either the Discovery Channel or the History Channel that really looked into this, who was in the picture and who wasn't. And so Schultz finally got added. And then the last guy was a guy named Keller that was added. To it. So 3 of the 6 had been killed on Iwo: Mike Strank, Harlan Block, and Franklin Soapsley. Then they named Rene Gagnon and Jack Bradley and Ira. And so what happened was that as they began to do more research and look at the guys and what they were carrying, you know, one guy was carrying a pair of pliers and one guy was carrying this and one guy was carrying that. And they removed Rene and Jack from the list of the 6. Basically, you know, the only one that anybody really knew of who was actually in the photograph was Ira.
And ironically, and this is really interesting, Ira wanted nothing to do with this, right? The picture, it went fast, it exploded. I mean, it was, to put it in today's terms, viral. And he didn't want his name getting out. And he physically threatened somebody to say, "Don't tell him it was my name," right?
He threatened Rene Gagnon. That's another point, too, is that one source, I think, of his drinking as well was when they brought him back. And
your last third of the book, you kind of handle post-World War II, where right there is the alcoholism really, really comes to the forefront. But like I mentioned earlier when we were talking, it very much feels like to me, and I don't want to overstate this, right? Because you're a historian, you're writing history, but there's kind of this understated anger, I feel like, from you that this part of his life is just that drunken Indian trope that you just mentioned, right? That it was just written off as that. And I mean, especially from today's lens, where we're getting a better understanding of PTSD, right? Of the type of life he grew up with, and then some of the worst fighting of World War II, that he's missing that grace when people tell his story, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, PTSD was kind of a handle back then. It was, you know, the 1,000-yard stare or shell shock, or they even called it combat neurosis and this kind of stuff. And usually it was handled, you know, well, you need a vacation. A slap on the back and have a drink, buddy. You know, and that kind of thing. And that was the way that it was handled. It's not very much different now. I thought that there would be a real difference, I guess, when they came up with the PACT Act and said that there is such a thing as being in a particular location, that you're going to have pretty much a foregone conclusion that you're going to have something as a result. And they said this presumed location, that those are the words that are used in the PACT Act, presumed location for hypertension. And that's what they use. Of course, they should be able to use presumed location for PTSD, period. All the work that I've done just looking into PTSD, anybody that's in it, you know, they might say that, well, there's only a 50% or whatever. No, it's 100%. You're going to be scared. You're going to have incidents that are going to be very, very disturbing, whether you're in supply or something like that, and you get, you know, some sort of raid on your company or whatever, or your supply tent, and that happens. They're trying to very much limit it, I think, because it's a bureaucracy.
Well, especially in Ira's case, we've talked about it. The military has a drinking culture. They still do. Right. And there's a lot of back away from it, but they still do. I mean, I remember I came back from Iraq and I remember for days, took 30 days of leave, go out, and it's like, you were at war. It's time to go to the bar and tell a story. And I mean, I remember for 30 days, I didn't pay for a single drink, which means you don't want to be rude and turn it down, which means you got to drink it. And there's just this cycle that it puts you in, right? And for my own PTSD, I look back now and realize that there was a lot of self-medicating. But the fact that it's part of the culture, too, means no one's going to notice, because this is what we do anyway, right?
I firmly believe that if Ira would have stayed in the Marine Corps, he would have been fine. He would have been a 30-year guy, first sergeant, gunnery sergeant, whatever, and gotten out at 30. He didn't, primarily because the folks needed him at home. As far as the drinking culture in the military, again, that's one of those binge kind of deals, you know? You know, if you were still in, you know, you might get liberty for a weekend. By God, Monday morning, you better be back and, you know, and stand and talk. And so that's that kind of culture. I you know, I've talked to a lot of guys, even blue collar guys from Cleveland. You know, I've talked to guys in there, you know, and they says, oh, yeah, we, you know, we work, you know, 8 hours in the union and, you know, I'm going on this and we're, you know, putting out steel and whatever. And, you know, hard work. And then on the weekends, by God, you go out and drink. It's not a social drinking, you know, have the cocktail, you know, when you get off work kind of culture. It's just not. So, you know, the hardworking guys, they go out there and do their hard work and then, you know, and then relax.
Well, Tom, listen, the book's fantastic. Thanks so much for writing it. Appreciate you coming on. And that's it for this episode. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. Ira Hayes, go out and grab it, people. It's a really, really good book. In the meantime, hit us up Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are also on Threads. Appreciate your support. Listen to the podcast. Send us comments. Anything, right? We want to hear from you. We love to hear from you. Please do it. Until next time, stay cool, nerds.